This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A few years ago, Lisa Napoli was living in Los Angeles working for Marketplace Radio and feeling a little burned out. She took a positive psychology class, and that helped some. And then she met a handsome stranger at a party who suggested she go to Bhutan. And that helped a lot. Lisa traveled to the remote Himalayan hamlet and volunteered her services as a journalist to the first ever non-government-run radio station. Just before she arrived in Bhutan, the king peacefully abdicated his throne. So Lisa was eyewitness to the country's transition from kingdom to constitutional monarchy, though some political difficulties remain. The story of the changes in Bhutan and the changes in Lisa's worldview are chronicled in her new book, Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. Lisa Napoli reads tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, but first she joins me in the studio. Welcome back to North Carolina.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
It's good to have you. You lived in Greensboro in the late 80s and 90s. What brought you there?
I went to work for WGHP Television, which was then an ABC affiliate. I was a young journalist. I'd moved out of CNN, where I'd started my career, and what a lucky break that I got to come live in this beautiful place.
You were at CNN kind of way back in the early days when everybody thought this is crazy, 24-hour news never work, right?
They called it chicken noodle news. Remember that? It was such an industry joke, and it was propelled by young 20-something journalists, which is why it was so interesting to end up in Bhutan working with young 20-something journalists many years later.
You went then from Greensboro, you made your way to L.A.?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But in between, I worked at the New York Times in the early days of the internet. When
That'll never make it.
When people thought it was so weird. Such a weird thing. And nobody wanted to cover it. So they had to hire a whole C team to cover the internet in the New York Times. And we all got lucky because we had a front row seat to this amazing revolution. So, and then I went to MSNBC and ended up at L.A. in L.A. at Marketplace, which was so lucky.
Yeah, you were living the journalist life, man, all over the country.
All over.
And that seems like a lot of travel, and a good job. I mean, public radio. I admire you people in public radio. It's so great.
Public radio is a pretty good thing.
Pretty good
thing. And people respect it, right?
They
it's good cocktail party chit-chat when you say your name. Everybody knows who you are, for sure.
So call now, 1-800-962. No, I was just going to do a pledge break, but we won't do that.
You forgot what you were doing.
What I'm doing is talking to you about working at Marketplace, a great job, but you're not feeling so good about it. There comes a point where it's just not for you anymore.
Frank, I think everybody gets to the point where no matter what they've got kids and a loving spouse and a great house and a great job, and they think, why did I do this? Why did I go this way instead of that way? And in my case, it was very seemingly glamorous, but I didn't have a marriage. I had been married as a young woman and was no longer. I didn't have kids. I didn't have a house any longer. And I just sort of hit a wall and thought, why am I doing what I'm doing? What can I do differently? I'm starting to get the wrinkles and see the gray hair. Got to look at the rest of my life. What am I going to do? But of course, like most things, you can't plan what you're going to do. I just sort of collided into this really fantastic opportunity that helped me reframe this feeling of lack I had in my life. So it was a very interesting period. It's been an interesting period of
time.
And
that collision began at a party where you met a man named Sebastian.
Yes, handsome Sebastian. Poor handsome Sebastian, immortalized now. He was so wonderful. I just met him very briefly at a party and was struck by him, as we often all have at a certain point in our lives been just really hit by someone. He happened to be a friend of a friend, and he happened to be going to Asia, and he happened to have ties to the very mysterious and long sort of sequestered, secluded kingdom of Bhutan. And he was intrigued that I worked in public radio and got me invited to help start a radio station there.
Now, help start a radio station in an island, a mountain kingdom, in the Himalayan mountains. And this would have been the first, essentially, private radio station, the first non-state radio station, right?
Yes.
So you can help people kind of figure out how to make that happen. But what did it mean for you? You're volunteering, right?
Yeah. I basically had to take off time from work, unpaid, and pay my way over there. But I was so up against this sort of feeling of malaise, ennui, whatever you want to call it, that it just seemed like a worthy investment. You know, it's worth taking some dipping into savings, which I was lucky I had. And because I didn't have children to take care of or a mortgage to pay, and my boss was very open, J.J. Yore said, go ahead, just file a story or two while you're there. And off I went. And I didn't know what I was stepping into, but it just seemed like an interesting adventure and that if someone was going to give me the opportunity to take it, I might as well go that way.
And you knew something about the reputation of this place. In fact, you tried to impress Sebastian with your knowledge of this remote kingdom.
I was so intrigued that it was supposedly the happiest place on earth and that it didn't have television, which Sebastian immediately told me was not true any longer, that they had let TV in. But yes, I did try to dazzle him, and it didn't entirely work, but a little bit.
What did you find when you got there?
I found a place that was in a transition that was very much like my own, although, of course, it was a place as opposed to a person, and it was a kingdom opening up to the outside world, and I was opening up to the outside world, too. I'd never been to Asia, but this is unlike any place in Asia because it's almost completely undeveloped. There's just one main road that traverses the entire country, and I found people who were so welcoming and wonderful because they were so unaccustomed to seeing outsiders that for them, that was, you know, it was like a spaceship had landed in their orbit. And here I was, enthusiastic and excited to be with them, and they were equally enthusiastic and excited to show me around.
Well, tell me about one of the people you met. One of the first people was Na Wong. Tell us about her.
I met her. I met Na Wong Pam right off the plane. She was assigned at this radio station called Kuzu FM. Kuzu is hello. And she was the young woman assigned to sort of shepherd me through my time, my first 6 weeks there. And she was delightful and wonderful and very much like a little sister. She had been, she had lost her mother as a young girl and was a very feisty and driven person. She was very curious about the outside world, and we just immediately clicked. We just really had a great affection for each other. It's sisterly, maybe motherly. I was 20 years older. I am 20 years older than she is. And she just became this pivot point for me and still is in Bhutan that first time and all my trips back and in the book as well.
Well, tell us about the radio station itself.
So Kuzu FM looks nothing like this beautiful studio that we're sitting in right now. It was built in a kitchen in an old foreign minister's house. It was funded by the sale of the young king's BMW, which had been a gift, and basically created as a tool for the youth of Bhutan to talk about issues the way we use radio here to talk about issues. But it was a pivotal time in the kingdom because they were about to have a democratic election, its first one. And so the radio station was just seen, it was kind of like a college radio station in our mythic impression of that. It was kind of run down and shabby, but it really didn't have to be anything more than that because it was such a phenomenon to have broadcasting there and broadcasting with pop music. More and more people were driving cars, which meant they had car radios, and there hadn't been anything to listen to. And all of a sudden, there were friendly young voices playing pop music and talking about Buddhism, and it made it a complete sensation.
Well, what did they want to talk about? Buddhism? What else?
They wanted to talk about boys and girls and relationships, and they wanted to talk about rock music as they were discovering forms of music that they'd known a little bit about but had never really explored. What greater kick is there to do what you do, but even better to have to sit there and download music and figure out, you know, the history of it and the background. So they did a lot of that, more than they did news, although they did a little bit of news too, which mostly was taken from the newspapers there. But it was an interesting thing to watch.
And in terms of your stay, how did you manage your time? You stayed a couple weeks at a time, a month or two, then back and forth. How'd that go?
Well, the book is based basically on the first several trips that I have taken to Bhutan. I went that first time for 6 weeks because I still had this job at Marketplace. And then I came back and it stuck with me so much. I didn't know I was going to write a book when I went there. About a year later, I went back when it turned out accidentally to be the first election. Very fortuitous, because the monks declared the election, the auspicious days for the election, and that was after I'd bought my plane ticket. But then I've been back many times.
You should
times
consult
since.
The monks before you buy your plane ticket.
Always
you should know
consult
this.
The monks okay. before you do anything. But I've been back several times since and basically have used the time there just to visit people and just to be back at the radio station to work with the young journalists in the kingdom. There are a growing number of them. But it was just the first couple of times that are in this book.
Talking with Lisa Napoli. Her book is What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth, Radio Shangri-La. Was it Shangri-La?
What's Shangri-La? This is Shangri-La. This is Radio Shangri-La here, these beautiful studios. And North Carolina is really a beautiful place. But there is no place that's perfect. And I was having this conversation in Greensboro a couple of days ago with some friends who see the world beyond and want to visit it. The truth is, the world is pretty fantastic where you are right now. We're so fortunate that you can do the things that you do here. You can open up your eyes and see so much more. And Bhutan is fantastic, and I love it, and I'm so thankful to have gone there, but it's not perfect.
Did you have to go there to be able to say what you're saying now?
Absolutely. It just completely reframed how I look at the world and my appreciation for the world around me. But people who go there thinking it's perfect, and many people do. Many people go on vacation to Bhutan and come back and they have Bhutan fever. They think it's the perfect idyllic place. And it is beautiful, and it is not like anything you see here, but it's not perfect. It's grossly imperfect, as is everywhere.
Well, this is something you learned, and there's a parallel story that you include in the book. Nawang, you talked about her. She thought Shangri-La might be the United States.
As many young people in developing countries do. They watch movies, they watch TV, they think money, you know, it's easy for me to say this because I don't live in a country where the per capita income is $1,300 a person. But she saw wealthy outsiders coming to the kingdom. She met me, no matter how much I told her that I wasn't wealthy. Of course, comparatively, I was. And she really thought that the streets were paved with gold here. And if she could just get her foot on soil, then that would be it. Of course, that never is
well,
it.
Well, and you agreed to help her come to the U.S.
Yes, yes, because I wanted to show her the hospitality. Mm-hmm. She had shown me, and since I don't have children, it was a kick to think that I could help a young woman see a place that she always wanted to see. And I had even said to her before she came, you cannot stay here. You can't stay with me. Many people in Bhutan will offer to be your nanny, not your children's nanny. They want to take care of you.
I could use that.
Yeah,
actually.
We could all use a nanny. But I said, you can't stay here. And of course, not to give away the entire book, but she did. So she, like many young people, really had this vision of the big city as a place where if she just got here, she'd make a lot of money. And of course, as we all know, that's absolutely not true, especially for somebody who's not here and staying here legally. It's just
Well, and what's wonderful about the book is that you describe, and I think your two journeys, although you ended up in different places, in many ways you come to the same conclusion. Nawang learned much the same lesson you did, didn't she?
She did. She did. She's now back in Bhutan, working at the radio station, has a family, and I think she sees now. But it's true. It's what you need to do. You need to venture out and try to become a rock star and then not maybe have it work to see that you at least tried it. At least you dipped the toe in something different. And we both were very fortunate to run into each other at the moment in time in our lives that we did.
Was there a pivotal moment for you in Bhutan? I'm imagining, you know, we set up the story. Here you are, angsting over where you're going to go, looking at your life and not particularly happy with it. Oh, there's Shangri-La, let me go. And then realizing it's got clay soil just like every place else. Was there a pivotal moment when you realized what you're telling me right now?
Yeah. You know, I was walking up the side of a mountain to the sacred monastery with a group of people, a couple of expats like me who were there volunteering, and Nawang and several of the other people from the radio station. And that moment in time, the beautiful air and this improbably built monastery and this hours-long walk, which was quite arduous, just all collided for me and made me see a different sense of myself in the world and a different sense of place where it almost didn't even matter where I was. It was kind of, it was an epiphany. It was a transformation. It just sort of really switched everything from a feeling of lack to a feeling of abundance and a feeling that it didn't matter where I was, that I would be okay and that I could fit into the world and that it wasn't one place. It was just the experience of meeting a person and spending time, the privilege of spending time with a person, even if it's only for an hour. It was just so magnificent. And Yeah, I think that was the moment.
I want to talk to you about a little bit more about Bhutan itself. We've talked about this, the fact that the king voluntarily stepped down, made way for democracy. It all sounds good. There are some political problems. There are 100,000 or so Bhutanese refugees in camps around the world, mostly in Nepal and India. Mm-hmm. Many refugees have resettled in this country. What's that story?
Yeah, many of them are settled in this state. There's a refugee project at Duke. It's an interesting story, and as with everything else, it's a complex story. The Bhutanese people say that the Nepali people came in to work at first at their invitation to do jobs and build roads and service different properties the way the local people couldn't do or wouldn't do, and then wanted to stay. And the Bhutanese say they couldn't handle the Nepali influx. The Nepali people say that they were kicked out of the country because they believed differently, different religions, different ethnicities, ethnicity, and that the Bhutanese wanted ethnic purity, so that they were shunted out. They weren't welcomed back into Nepal, and for 20 years have lived in a refugee camp where their numbers have grown to 100,000. And only in the last year or so have people finally begun to be resettled in different communities around the world that have welcomed them in with, you know, great embrace, but also with great difficulty and adjustment because they didn't come in with money or lots of skills in many cases. So it's a complex and ugly side of Bhutan that doesn't get discussed a lot because people are so caught up in this happiest place on earth, Shangri-La business. And it's a very tough part of Bhutan's history.
Did the folks at the radio station want to talk about it?
Well, you know, as I got more comfortable there, I would talk to people about it. They definitely wouldn't talk about it on the air. It's starting to bubble up in other media now after 4 years of freedom of speech and newspapers and young journalists seeing that they can challenge the government and that they can discuss these things more openly. At that time, when I first went there 4 years ago, the people there were both afraid of saying anything that seemed critical of the government, but also I don't think that they understood it. Now I've had several really vibrant conversations with young Bhutanese people, some of whom have been educated outside of the country, who wish that the government would address the issue more directly. So you really start to see what we're seeing in the rest of the world right now. Young people saying, don't just put a blanket over it. Let us have open, honest dialogue and discourse. But that's, of course, an elders' issue. And there's still, you know, reluctance on the part of some people to challenge the elders. But I suspect that in the next 5 to 10 years, that won't be the case anymore.
You were there at a remarkable moment at this threshold where Bhutan crosses the threshold into modernity, particularly when it comes to communications. In just that short time since you've been there, what kind of changes have you seen just in terms of the way, just watching television and being able to talk on the radio?
Oh, it's remarkable. I feel so fortunate to have gone there when I did, and also concerned. I mean, the growth in the capital city of Thimphu is spectacular and terrifying. I mean, there's rampant development. If people have a little bit of money, they build. The roads, the internet infrastructure is intensifying and speeding up. That's getting more robust. Entrepreneurs, people are more, used to be the big job. If you had rural to urban migration, you came to the cities, you got a job behind a desk in the civil service, and that was it. You'd made it. Now that the civil service is very full, people want to start different businesses, and they're getting bank loans because now banking is opening up. There's outside money coming in.
Well, does this threaten the happiest place in the world, a place that values its gross national happiness?
Well, if you believe that there is a happiest place in the world, which of course, you know, some people do, sure it does. Consumerism, wanting stuff, wanting more stuff, building so much and not spending any time with your community can hurt you.
But you're back in L.A. now, the source of your ennui, and you're very happy.
I am very happy. I think I've reframed how I feel about things, and I'm participating more in my community in ways that I never have before by volunteering, participating in Bhutan's welfare as best I can financially and emotionally, and I just feel better than I ever have.
Lisa, it's a great book. So great to talk with you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Napoli's new book is called Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. She reads tonight at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh at 7:30. For more information, go to quailridgebooks.com. Coming up after a short break, the Sunset Limited comes to the Triad Stage. Stay with us on The State of Things.